and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to the 10th episode of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. Last time, we saw Poltava and all of its sweeping significance, and today that's where we're going to exhume our story. With the power of Sweden apparently shattered in the space of a day, with Charles XII fleeing to the Ottoman Empire's lands, the Tsar being triumphant, and Europe waking up to this new world order, Poltava had the effect of an immensely favourable announcement in the stock market of European opinion. Peter's stock, for so long slowly, cautiously edging its way upwards, suddenly shot up overnight, and the Tsar was eager to make the most of the victory. Charles's European order, on the other hand, which included a set of enforced peace treaties and a puppet Polish king, now all seemed in jeopardy. With the Swedish presence literally vanishing overnight, there seemed little outcome for those formerly oppressed princes, mainly Denmark and Augustus of Saxony, to repudiate the old peace and get on the bandwagon of avenging themselves against Sweden. Poltava had made this and so many other things possible, and as Tsar Peter proceeded to spread the word throughout his empire, it seemed that his fortunes had never risen so high. Yet Peter, like Charles, would have to learn the hard way that the greatest companion to triumph was often catastrophic defeat. Just as King Charles of Sweden had seen his hubris matched with a nemesis, so too would Peter soon see his. An Ottoman intervention was about to take place in an incredible sideshow of an already fascinating war. So let's get into it as I take you to the aftermath of Poltava in late June 1709. "Where is my brother Charles?" Tsar Peter asked. It was the afternoon, only a few hours removed from the most incredible victory Russia had ever achieved, and Tsar Peter was euphorically talkative, engaging most enthusiastically with his Swedish guests that had been captured. Field Marshal Renskjold, the man arguably responsible for much of the confusion and disaster of the previous morning, was his most prominent guest, but also present was the Swedish Prime Minister, Count Piper. Both men would no doubt have understood the gravity of this failure, and they likely had little time for a boastful Tsar. But Peter, to his credit, was gracious, respectful and courteous to men who were seeking his destruction only a few hours before. Peter asked, likely out of a sense of intense curiosity, how Charles XII had dared to invade such a large empire with such a small force. Renskjold gave the generic reply that he was required to do what his sovereign wished. "You are an honest fellow," Peter exclaimed, "and for your loyalty I return to you your sword." That sword, given to Renskjold by his king on an appointment to Field Marshal, symbolised the love and loyalty which Renskjold felt for Charles, but now he couldn't even be sure where his master was. Had the great and glorious conqueror really died on the battlefield? The last sighting of Charles was said to have been of him bleeding from an old wound, but Renskjold could learn little more. In fact, Peter had not even bothered to make any effort to pursue the Swedes until 5 p.m. that day. When he did, Renskjold and Count Piper would both learn the truth. King Charles XII of Sweden had in fact gotten away. Incredibly enough, Charles and his army, complete with their Cossack auxiliaries, had gathered only a few miles to the south in the original Swedish camp from which Poltava had been besieged. Now comforted only by Lievenhaupt, who tried to assure his king that much of the army still remained intact, Charles knew what must be done. While on paper he could muster a force of 21,000 men, composed of men left out from the earlier battle, its beleaguered survivors and the aforementioned Cossacks, the only true route to salvation was the one which would take them away from the Russians, and to do that they had to travel south, trace the border with the Ottoman lands, and then move back into Poland, where this bolstered army could make a new stand in Allied territory. It was imperative that the Swedish remnants move before the Russians discovered their vulnerability. The Swedes had been plainly shattered, and morale was at an all-time low. There was no stomach for fighting, and Charles needed to get away if he was to preserve his domains from whatever Russian resurgence that was to follow. Following their Cossack guides, they made their way south to where the river Vorskla flowed into the Dnieper. The Dnieper was a huge, intimidating body of rushing water that ran parallel to the border of the Ukraine with the Crimean Tartars' lands, but this option was upheld to be the only one remaining. With Russians on all sides, there was no hope of a breakout in these conditions. It was as a disciplined army, rather than as an unruly mob, that Charles's forces moved south. In spite of the defeat, the Swedes were still very capable of carrying themselves with dignity, especially as the king was in their midst, and still vulnerable in his wounded state. Charles still had to be carried everywhere, and he, like his men, was exhausted from the last day of events. Since the battle had effectively started at midnight, the soldiers had been awake in some cases for many, many hours, and the lack of sleep combined with the profound shock of the loss compounded the sense of fatigue. By the time they reached the Dnieper 2 days later, the feeling of exhaustion was accompanied only by a sense of panic. Many of the soldiers in their condition couldn't hope to swim the wide set, raging torrent of a river that lay before them. Even those in good physical condition would have had an immensely difficult time crossing. At this, Leeuwenhaupt and Charles arrived at a solution. The king would cross with a small detachment and proceed onwards to the safety of the Tartar Khan, while Leeuwenhaupt would attempt to fight his way through the Russians and link up with Charles in Poland. As a plan, it was as naive as it was hopeless. Already, by the first day of marching, the Swedes were informed that the Russians and Cossacks allied to them were close behind, so little time could be had to prepare defences. Leeuwenhaupt insisted, though, that, if it proved necessary, he would fight the Russians if he couldn't get away. Thus comforted, Charles crossed the raging river with much help from his aides. Now the ordeal remained to proceed further south and cross the Bug River. This was the actual border of the Ottoman Empire with the rest of Europe, and it required a near 200-mile hike through impenetrable grasses to the southeast. The grass was as high as a man in many places, and progress was difficult, so much so that Ivan Mazepa, that old leader of the Cossacks who had defected to the Swedish side, caught up with Charles and urged him to move faster. The region in between the Bug and Dnieper rivers was left deliberately desolate and uncultivated so that it served as the buffer lands between the Ottoman Empire and the Ukraine, and for a week, Charles and his party struggled through this region in despair. Just as he and his allies crossed the river, Charles was able to look on the other side and watch the remaining members of his party be cut to pieces by the pursuing Russians. He had only just made it. In time, Charles would learn that Leeuwenhaupt, his trusty deputy, had not been so lucky. Rather than contest the Russian supremacy, Leeuwenhaupt reasoned that it made far more sense to surrender and end the suffering of his men. Understanding that Leeuwenhaupt planned to fight no matter what the commander actually meant, he said, was that he would fight if circumstances proved favourable. So it was that at 11 a.m. on the 1st of July 1709, Leeuwenhaupt surrendered the entire remnants of the Swedish army to the pursuing Russians. With that, it was official. The entirety of the once fearsome army that Charles had led in splendour into Russia 2.5 years before was now completely gone. With its destruction, there was now nothing left to stop the effective powers from overturning everything that Charles had built over the last few victorious years. Without much deliberation, both King Frederick IV of Denmark and Augustus of Saxony set about to do just that. Peter had sent a catalogue of letters abroad in the aftermath of Poltava. He remained in the depleted camp for 2 days, for the express purpose of writing as much as his hand could bear the necessary letters to the interested heads of state. Of particular interest to Peter was the Duke of Marlborough, whom Peter understood had met with King Charles on the eve of the king's departure from Saxony. Marlborough's incredulous response further illuminated the significance of what Peter had just done and what Charles had just lost. He wrote to London, "We have no confirmation as yet of the battles between the Swedes and Muscovites, but should it be true of the first being so entirely beaten as is recorded, what a melancholy reflection it is that after constant success for 10 years, he, Charles, should in 2 hours mismanagement and ill success ruin himself and his country." As Charles recuperated in his Ottoman captivity and Peter recovered from an illness of his own in Kiev, Augustus of Saxony took the opportunity to strike. Declaring the Treaty of Altranstadt signed with Charles in September 1706 now to be illegal, Augustus wasted no time in persuading his electorate to once again sponsor him to pursue the Polish crown. Furnished with 14,000 Saxons, he marched across Europe again to seize the crown from Stanislaus. Now in a perilous position, owing to Charles's defeat and the complete absence of any Swedish force from the continent, Stanislaus could not rely on the power base that he had been building for the last 5 years. Instead, the elements that had once faithfully supported the Swedish sponsor now abandoned him with all the emotion and passion as they had originally supported him. Stanislaus was dumbstruck that Charles could have met such a striking and absolute end after so many years of stunning successes. Indeed, to Stanislaus, as well as much of Europe, the idea that a single battle could have such a devastating, transformative result seemed impossible when weighed against the standards of warfare in the West. Of course, we know that Charles had been losing in Russia for some time, and that Poltava was merely the confirmation, the exclamation point, that all had not been well in the Swedish camp for some time. But for foreign observers, Peter's victory seemed like a heaven-sent bolt out of the blue. Respectfully, those ministers who had once scorned the Russian envoys present in their capitals now declared that they had all the time in the world for them, and they informed the Russian agents to tell the Tsar of their warmest congratulations. Early in October 1709, still flushed with victory, Peter met with Augustus on his royal barge near the city of Thorn. The relationship between the two men must have been something to behold. 11 years had passed now since their original meeting, where Augustus had first posed the idea of a Livonian land grab to the Tsar, and in that time, it seemed as though everything had changed, and it wasn't just the fact that the Swedish king was suddenly absent from the equation. In his book Poland: A History, Adam Zamoyski noted perceptively how the balance of power between the two allies had now shifted. Zamoyski put it that when he and Peter had planned the Northern War that night in 1698, he, Augustus, had been the stronger partner. After 10 years of bungling, he was little more than the Tsar's client, dependent upon his support and protection. There was no clear way out of the predicament for him or the Commonwealth, as the balance in Eastern Europe had been altered dramatically during those 10 years. From this, it is not surprising to learn that Augustus was nervous to meet the Tsar, whom he hadn't seen since he broke his vows to Peter and made a peace at Russia's expense. Peter insisted there was no hard feelings. He was warm and considerate, and even made time for some symbolic irony. "I always wear the cutlass you gave me," Peter remarked, "but it seems you do not care for the sword I gave you, as I see you are not wearing it." Falling over himself in a bid not to offend the man who was now effectively his patron as much as his friend, Augustus reasoned that in his haste to depart from Dresden and reclaim the Polish throne, he had left the sword which Peter had given him behind. "Ah," Peter replied, "then let me give you another," whereupon the Tsar signalled for Augustus's old sword to be brought in, found as it had been amongst Charles's baggage train at Poltava. Augustus's eyes lit up at the sight of this sword, and then he recognised that he had been caught out. Clearly he hadn't been as sentimental as the Tsar when it came to giving gifts, but Peter laughed it off. Nothing was going to dampen his mood now, especially in light of how the tide was definitely turning in Europe. By the end of October 1709, Russian troops had secured all of the Commonwealth from any remnants of Stanislaus' regime, and they had ensured that Augustus was thoroughly supported for the round two part of his reign. How the magnates of the Republic viewed this Saxon returning once again to claim his prize, we cannot know for sure, but the spectacle of the Commonwealth effectively lying prostrate before any invader capable of bribing or cajoling its major families into approving a potential candidate for the throne was a telling one. The last few years had plainly wrought havoc on the once proud Republic, which looked utterly removed from the trying but still triumphant years of Sobieski a generation before. The civil war, the changing of the crowns, and the heavy military presence of the Russians, Cossacks, and Swedes sweeping across its lands had taken an immeasurable toll on the infrastructure and capabilities of the Commonwealth to resist and to defend itself. On the 9th of October 1709, Augustus and Peter signed an alliance which pledged Poland, Lithuania, and Russia to fight Sweden together and join against Peter's enemies. Peter's major goals were to secure the Baltic so that Petersburg would be safe, while Augustus still desired the Livonian provinces, and Peter still promised to give them to him. In his second tour across Europe, Peter met with Frederick of Prussia, who had actually been tied to Sweden with an alliance for the last few years, since Charles's power had grown so inestimable during the last fat years of victory. Now, typically in the tradition of the opportunistic electors of Brandenburg, Frederick was more than willing to partake in a land grab against Sweden. Also willing to join in the party was Denmark, and the Danes concluded an alliance with Russia almost immediately when Poltava was learned of. The Danes invaded the southern Swedish border with Norway, as well as the Duchy of Holstein on the southern European border of Denmark proper. King Frederick IV of Denmark also elected to lease his navy to any would-be aggressor that wanted to do damage to Swedish naval interests. With all of these threats arising at once, Stockholm, understandably, was reaching a point of desperation. They lamented the tactical errors of their king as much as his absence, while they also feared what may happen if the Ottoman Empire demanded a high ransom for his release. Getting word on Charles's condition proved difficult, and the Ottoman visit by that king seemed more like a prison than a sanctuary. While Peter continued his tour, he arranged two marriages between his son and niece, to the daughter of the Duke of Wolfenbüttel, a minor German ducal house, and to the Duke of Courland, respectively. The latter also happened to be a nephew of Frederick of Prussia, and so that Elector King's approval was required as a polite formality before Peter continued to Riga to have some sweet revenge. The fortress city of Riga was the anchor of Sweden's Baltic Empire, and Peter felt he had some score to settle with it after it had initially frustrated his 1700 campaign, and before when he had been badly handled there during his Grand Embassy. Peter fired several shots at the walls of Riga himself on the 13th of November, apparently satisfied that the jewel of the Baltic would soon be his. He then visited Petersburg again and laid the foundations for some new churches, as well as launching a new warship from the burgeoning port. In triumphal procession, the Tsar then returned to Moscow for the Christmas period. From the 20th of December 1709, a huge victory parade in Moscow began, highlighting the great gains and victories made in the last campaign, and giving thanks to God for the fortitude of the Tsar. Swedish prisoners made the bulk of the parade's attraction, and Foreign Minister Renskjöld led his charges through this alien city that they had once imagined seizing from the now victorious Tsar. It must have seemed as though they were walking through a dream world, but thousands of miles to the southeast, their master had not slackened. Already, Charles XII was making plans for a revenge more terrible and catastrophic than Peter could possibly have imagined. In the time and honoured traditions of Muslim hospitality, when Charles XII moved into the other side of the Bug River, and thus the territory of the Ottoman Empire, he became a guest of the Sultan. The King of Sweden and the Cossack Hetman had both sought asylum in their time of need, and it was a duty greatly felt by the Sultan to accommodate them. As soon as he was made aware of the esteem of his Swedish guests, the Sultan rushed to make them more comfortable. Large fruits and meats, such as that which the starved and exhausted Swedes had never even seen, were brought for them to feast upon, and within a week, at the local Pasha's suggestion, Charles and his party were brought further to the southeast to a camp along the River Dniester, where they would be safer. It was here that Charles and his company would remain for the next three eventful years. The entire experience began with a series of bitter blows that would have sent a lesser prince spiralling into an irredeemable depression. First, Charles's stubborn foot wound refused to heal, inflicting on him a series of fevers and infections for over 2 months. Second, he was made aware that his elder sister, the Duchess of Holstein, had died from measles. Third, after a long illness, the wiry old hetman of the Cossacks, Ivan Mazepa, also died. Charles, by then a dishevelled, sunken man, attended Mazepa's funeral, but had to be carried as he still couldn't properly stand. The wound on his foot was like a constant reminder of Poltava. Every time he took a step, it reminded him that he had lost. In Charles's constantly grasping mind, though, Poltava only had to matter as much as he let it. Considering the facts, he believed there was reason to be positive. Lievenhaupt, at least, would be able to make himself secure in Poland, and after a short spell in the Turkish lands, Charles would be able to join him. So it was, after all these blows, Charles then learned as well in late September 1709 that Liebenhaupt had surrendered, that Poland had been reclaimed by Saxony, and that Peter was on the march across Europe as Sweden's empire contracted and frayed. The route home through Poland was now blocked by soldiers supplied by Peter and Augustus, while the Danes had also resumed their rivalry with their hated neighbour and struck in Sweden's perennial weak spots. Everywhere he looked or listened, disaster seemed to abound. Yet again, making all he could of the position he now found himself, Charles sought to put the next phase of his plan, the only phase left, into motion. He would induce the Ottomans, by hook or by crook, to make war on Tsar Peter's Russia and reverse the great misfortunes which had recently crowned his otherwise triumphant reign. Beginning in the autumn of 1709, as Charles waited along the Dniester, two Swedish agents were sent with full powers from the king to negotiate in Constantinople. There, they found a regime kept in check by the combination of Peter Tolstoy's influence and the apathy for war felt by the Sultan. Tolstoy, that Russian agent, had been immensely fruitful as an agent for the Tsar. It was thanks in large part to him that earlier deputations of Tartars had been unable to persuade the Ottomans to invade Russia, and thus they ensured that Russia would not have to fight a two-front war. Had Tolstoy not been successful, and had the Ottomans combined with Charles's campaign, Peter's fate would surely have been sealed. Now, Tolstoy remained in place. Charles's side possessed few strategic advantages, and Peter seemed to have utterly turned the tables. Yet, the Swedish king still believed that he could induce the Ottomans to make war. To do so, he would have to send his agents to court the war party in Constantinople, led by the Sultan's mother of all people, while he would also have to remain on good terms with the belligerent Khan of the Tartars, and a key element in the coming conflict, Delvet Gire. In the past, the Khan of the Tartars, Gire, had been disappointed at his master's inaction. Now, with the news of Charles's defeat and the empowerment of Russia, the Khan insisted that the time had come to cut off the head of the snake before the Sultan himself was devoured. Incredibly, through a combination of heavy bribery and the persuasion of the Sultan's mother, the Sultan gave his approval for war with Russia on the 21st of November, 1710. Peter had not helped his case during the course of the Swedish-Ottoman intrigues. Part of the position of the Swedish agents had been to paint Russia as the danger that had to be snuffed out before it was too late. And Peter added to this image by sending increasingly brisk demands to the court at Constantinople for the return of their guest, King Charles. The Sultan, adamant that he could not break the customs of hospitality and asylum, which were held so dearly, insisted that such a request could not be met. Peter, flushed with victory, didn't seem to realise the danger. Believing his position strong, with his enemies far off and his empire on the ascendant, Peter had grand plans drawn up for expansion into the Balkans. It was along the coast of the Black Sea that the Christian vassals of the Sultan, in Wallachia and Moldavia, were found, and these vassals promised Peter great gains and their hearty support if he elected to free them from the Ottoman yoke. With promises from the vassals of a total of 40,000 men, Peter marched south with only 40,000 infantry and 16,000 cavalry of his own. The Sultan, traditionally enough, raised an army stupidly out of proportion to this Russian effort at an eye-watering 200,000 men. The following spring in 1711, the first moves of this curious sideshow of the Great Northern War were to begin. Peter marched south, intending to crown Poltava with the Christian triumph of crusade, with a victory such that he had tried to bring about a decade before, where his great embassy had sought out allies for a war against the Turks. Now that he was granted that war, Peter proclaimed the crusade, and he marched with his wife and most of his court to the Danubian principalities, while the Ottomans moved slowly up through the empire, reaching the Danube only at the beginning of June 1710. It was while massing at this last stop before the campaign that the Grand Vizier sent one of Charles's agents back to him at his camp with the interesting offer. Would the King of Sweden like to join the Grand Vizier on his campaign as a guest of the Ottomans? For a time, Charles prepared his things, eager to avenge himself on the Russians. Eventually, though, he was persuaded that it would not be politique to follow the Ottomans as a subordinate of the Ottoman commander, and in a decision he was later much to regret, he elected to stay behind in his camp as the Ottomans passed by. Celebrating the second anniversary of Poltava in late June 1711, Peter prepared to meet the Ottoman advance. He anticipated that the campaign would be a brief one, brief enough to enable him to return home and attend his son's wedding before the year was out. In the meantime, the seemingly endless manpower reserves of Russia were drawn on again, as Augustus received 12,000 soldiers in addition to 100,000 rubles to maintain his position in the Commonwealth and chase down any remaining vestiges of resistance to his newly installed regime. As he generously doled out the resources to his significant ally, Peter called on all Christian subjects of the Sultan, Orthodox or otherwise, to rise up and drive the Turks out and ensure that, in Peter's words, "the descendants of the heathen Muhammad were driven out in their own homeland to the sands and steppes of Arabia." As Peter moved his forces down south through Moldavia, he was made aware of some unfortunate news. The Sultan had reached Wallachia first, and forced to choose, the Prince of Wallachia had renounced his original support of the Tsar in return for keeping his own head. Wallachia's contingent of men far outstripped that of Moldavia's, and at a stroke, the Tsar had lost something akin to 30,000 potential soldiers. But, despite this, he remained confident of success. Advancing down the River Pruth, it is interesting to note that less than 100 miles to the east, in the town of Bender, resided Charles XII, eagerly awaiting news of the clash between the two sides. Having committed himself so fully to his advance deep into enemy territory, Peter was about to mimic his old rival in all the worst ways. As if to drive the point home that he was not free of him yet, Charles ensured that a Swedish and exiled Polish contingent accompanied the force now reaching closer to Peter's position along the Pruth River. From the men in these contingents would Charles later learn exactly how severe Peter's position had been. The advance guards of both armies caught sight of one another on the 8th of July 1711. As the Ottomans began to cross to the different sides of the river, the Tsar's position became untenable. He would have to withdraw from the overwhelming numbers before it was too late. With this in mind, Tsar Peter organised a hasty retreat on the night of the 9th of July, with the intention of reuniting with a fallback Russian camp in the marshlands about 10 miles to the north. Once secure in their position after a traumatic and costly retreat, where much of the baggage and supplies were lost, Peter's men were then told to dig trenches and reinforce their camp. The morning of the 11th of July brought the first concentrated attack by the Janissaries, but Russian discipline held and the elite units were pushed back. At this, trenches were dug around the Russian camp by the Ottomans, an ominous signal that their position could soon become desperate. By the end of the 11th of July, it was clear exactly how inescapable the Tsar's position had become. On both sides of the river he was surrounded, while horses and bands of infantry used their superiority in numbers to essentially form a net around the Russian position. In the Tsar's camp were his wife, much of the court's treasury, and the most experienced commanders in the empire. The heat of the summer was unbearable, shelter was next to non-existent from the incessant musketry, and then it was learned that the Ottomans had brought their cannons, 300 strong, to within direct range of the Russian camp. At such a range and with such firepower, the Turks could simply pulverize the Russians to pieces. The situation, indeed, was even worse than that which Charles had faced at Poltava. Yet, the critical difference between the Tsar and the King was that Peter, unlike King Charles, was quite willing indeed to negotiate. For someone who had spent the last decade and a half building up his empire, Peter was completely willing to give it all away. In fact, he was even willing to grant the Ottomans the concession of a lifetime, to allow their guest and presumed ally Charles the opportunity to return to Sweden, where all of his Baltic dependencies would be returned, and Stanislaus would be allowed to return to rule in Poland in place of Augustus. In the summer of 1710, Russian forces had expelled the last vestiges of Swedish rule, and they had captured the entire Baltic belt for Russia's empire. Contrary to Augustus's wishes, Peter had decided to hold on to these Baltic provinces rather than give them to Poland. But in this desperate situation, Peter now seemed willing to give all of it back. The only thing that he wanted to keep, it seemed, was St. Petersburg. But if that was not acceptable, he would sell the sacred city of Pskov, as well as other whole provinces, including the entirety of Ukraine, and a gift of 150,000 rubles for the Sultan, to be paid annually if requested. that Peter had been willing to give the kitchen sink if necessary provides a further contrast between he and Charles. Where Peter was willing to accept that he was beaten and offer terms, Charles's defiance, stubbornness or tenacity, whatever you want to call it, had prevented him from sacrificing anything, and so he had lost it all. We don't know if Peter actually learned anything from his Swedish rival, but he certainly understood the importance of living to fight another day. Surrounded on all sides on the River Pruth, there was no question that Peter could attack or break out. He would risk his own person and regime, as much as that of his wife, and the tsardom he had spent the last 15 years building. To Peter, Russia's tsarist regime, as much as its empire, were of the utmost importance. In his mind, the latter would survive long after he had gone, while the former could be snuffed out upon his death. Incredibly then, the completely supreme Grand Vizier approved the peace overtures, in the process granting Peter one of the most fortunate breaks of his life. Far from demanding the kitchen sink and all the other appliances which Peter was prepared to give, Peter was essentially required to give up his Black Sea ambitions and allow Charles to return home. There was no mention of reimbursement, of Poland, or of the Baltic. Peter would trade his southern adventures, which, granted, had occupied him for the better part of 15 years, in return for security in the European theatre, where Peter believed most was at stake. This was a painful decision, but not nearly as painful as he had expected. His envoy had worked wonders, and apparently saved him from the greatest disaster of his reign. Like Poltava, it seemed, the Pruth had also been the Tsar's saving grace. Then came the startling rumour from those in the camp. They couldn't be sure, but whispers from the other side suggested that the Grand Vizier was entertaining a significant guest in his tent. The rumoured guest was none other than the King of Sweden, Charles XII, who had just ridden for 17 straight hours in his quest to persuade the Vizier to use his overwhelming force to crush the Tsar against the River Pruth and be done with it. After what had originally seemed like an incredible turnaround in the aftermath of Poltava, Peter's self-confidence and foolishness had now brought him to this desperate position, and face to face with the consequences of his hubris, the man who was his nemesis, Charles XII. As tensions rose along the Pruth River on the evening of the 13th of July, 1711, it seemed as though Peter's great comeback was to be denied. Perhaps as much as a few hundred metres away from him, Charles XII now worked with the exact same tenacity to move the Grand Vizier on and break the peace as he had employed in his original invasion of Peter's empire. Peter held his breath, Charles held his ground, and for the moment, the Ottomans held their fire. Next time, we'll resume this incredible story to see where it brought Peter, Charles, and the rest of Europe next. Until then, thank you so much for listening to Poland Is Not Yet Lost. And thank you for supporting this show as well. This has been episode 10. I have been Zach Twomley, and you've been great. Thanks for everything, and I'll be seeing you all soon.